Why am I going to talk about colds and flus today? Because you can hear this voice that sounds like one of those ladies that sits at the slot machines in Vegas smoking cigarettes, or somebody who stayed in Vegas one day too long. Yep, it happens even to me. A week ago, I got a cold. And Grandma taught us the primary rule. If you treat a cold, it lasts a week, and if you don't treat a cold, it lasts 7 days. Yeah, silly as that is, it's really true. And, you know, one of the first myths that we want to bust about colds and flus is that they happen because you have a weak immune system. That is absolute poppycock. Absolute nonsense. We don't get colds and flus because we have weak immune systems. We get colds and flus because we fail to pay attention to the very first signs and do something about them right away. And so as we learn today a little bit more about how the immune system works, we'll understand that it isn't a weak immune system. You know, you've got about 200 different cold viruses that have been identified. And once you've had a particular kind of cold, I call it cold number 56, then you never get cold number 56 again. You can get 55, you can get 57, but you can't ever get 56 again because you develop an antibody to it. But our bodies are continuously under attack. They're under attack from the air that we breathe, the water we drink, the food that we eat. You know, the air that we breathe is saturated with smoke and carbon monoxide and dirt particles and fumes and chemicals. We handle waste products. We handle garbage. We handle all sorts of things that, you know, we don't even know where they came from. We eat food that's teeming with bacteria. And I know you germaphobes out there are going to freak when I say that, but it's really true. We drink water that if you put it under a microscope, well, it kind of looks like a circus. It's got so many activities going on. It looks more like a biology experiment than a refreshment. In fact, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from the first breath that we take until the last breath that we exhale, we are constantly being bombarded with enemies that want to control us, that want to take over us. You know, I said on a show a couple of weeks ago that only 10% of all the DNA in our body is human. Hear that. 90% of the DNA in our body is from microbes. It's a wonder we survive, much less remain healthy most of our lives. And even when we do get sick, we manage to heal in a fairly short period of time. This defense immune system, an amazingly intricate collection of, well, cells and organs and systems and structures and chemicals, all of which are designed to identify foreigners and attack them, to destroy them before harm is done to the body. So there's four critters that come after us: bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites. And we can't forget cancer cells, even though we make them ourselves. They don't come after us, but they certainly can repeatedly arise in various organs, very determined to multiply until they take control of the body. But they're also recognized as not welcome and eliminated. So when we look at these four attackers, the immune system takes care of most of that. It's very aggressive in attacking enemies. Sometimes it even overshoots its mark. It becomes too aggressive. I had a new client in the practice last week that has pretty severe allergic reactions, an excessive response to an intruder. Doesn't matter whether it's a pollen or a mite or a dog dander. So the immune system can even get confused. It can take a normal body structure and think of it as a foreigner and attack it and create what's known as an autoimmune disease. There's 50 to 200 autoimmune diseases, depending on whose literature you read, from Graves' disease and Hashimoto's thyroiditis to MS to rheumatoid arthritis to lupus. I mean, a lot of them recognized and others whose names you wouldn't know. But generally on a day-to-day basis, we enjoy the protection of a normally functioning immune system, and we take it for granted. When we look at, you know, somebody who's got abnormal cells, you know, taken over as what happens when we get a cancer of the immune system, like leukemia or lymphoma or multiple myeloma, then we understand that an immune system gone wrong can actually be tragic. But we want to learn a little bit better how this immune system works and how we can use it to treat, how we can support it, how we can keep from offending it. Because the targets of the immune system, the bacteria, the viruses, the fungi, the parasites, they all work a slightly different way. They all create a reaction a slightly different way. And they all have parts of the immune system that work on them uniquely. Think of the immune system as your body's own defense department. And just like the defenses of this nation, there are several different branches. And most people, when they think of the immune system, if they really think, they might think of white blood cells because they're the backbone of the immune system. If you cut yourself and you look at your blood, you think of it as a red, you know, liquid that's pretty much all the same all the way through. But if you put it in a test tube and allow it to stand for a while, it'll separate. And if you spin it in a centrifuge, you'll cause even more layers. And about half of that blood that will take up the space in that test tube is a layer of red blood cells. This is what carries oxygen to the body. This is one of the reasons that when I talk about diabetes and when I talk about high sugar contents, that I warn you about having glycolated hemoglobin. Because whenever you take the protein hemoglobin and you hook it to oxygen, that it carries oxygen and you hook it to sugar, then it can't carry oxygen. Think of a red blood cell like a dump truck driving through your bloodstream with oxygen as its payload. And if I fill the bed of that dump truck up with sugar, then that dump truck can no longer carry oxygen, and we need to carry oxygen to the far reaches of the body. You know, when we look back at that test tube after that red blood cell has settled out, the top half of the layer is kind of a clear yellow fluid, and it's called serum. And that's the fluid in which the blood cells are suspended as they run through the body. Without it, the blood would be too thick to flow freely. And the white blood cells are in the test tube are confined to a thin layer that's sandwiched between those red blood cells on the bottom of the test tube and the serum at the top of the test tube, something called the Buffy coat. Red cells outnumber white cells by 500,000 to 1, but for what white cells lack in number, they sure make up in ability. There's many types of them, and they perform all varieties of functions, and there are different roles for the immunity in the body. We have white blood cells that secrete antibodies to fight off foreign invaders. So you've heard of individuals that have an antibody to oak trees. One of the reasons that we're going to cover allergies in this class here at the station on the 11th of February is because February is when pine and oak and cedar bloom, and a lot of people in Sarasota County suffer from airborne allergies. And these specialized white blood cells called B cells, B because the cells are trained in the bone, they manufacture these antibodies to fight off these pollens. Then we've got white blood cells called T cells, and you might have heard of them because they've been brought to people's attention as a result of HIV/AIDS. T cells are what are affected by the HIV virus, and they coordinate all sorts of segments of the immune system to make an attack against the enemy. So white blood cells have a very specific function, like T cells and B cells, and there are ones that are sort of nonspecific. And when we realize that these white blood cells that run along not only in the blood, but also in the body's lymphatic system, which is really the body's sanitation department, it disposes the garbage that occurs in the blood. It, you know, when the blood gets polluted by some sort of toxin, it's the lymphatic system that helps to clear it out. So when we begin to look at these white blood cells and these various kinds of white blood cells, we've got white blood cells that actually chew up bad guys. If you remember the old Pac-Man game, and I realized when I was talking to a teenager recently that I dated myself by talking about Pac-Man, they actually will chomp onto the foreign invader, chew it up. There are other activities that take place with the white blood cells where they make a chemical. And that chemical actually destroys the membrane of the cell. And as a result, the cell is affected and dies. There are specialized components in your blood called complements that actually poke holes in the cell so that the cell loses its integrity. So, you know, that old adage that you should keep a keener eye on your enemy than you do on your friends. Well, that's true when we're talking about the immune system. People typically think of the immune system as a means of fighting off infection, but that's not its sole function. An infection is when there's an invasion of some sort of an infectious organism, like a cold. That happens to be a virus. It's not a bacteria. It's not a fungi. It's not a parasite. They're all capable of entering the body, of multiplying, of causing an infection. But the nature of viruses are unique. And they're unique and different from bacteria because bacteria are the smallest living organism that can eat and grow and multiply on its own. They're teeny tiny, teeny tiny. Some of them are round like little balls, and some of them are shaped like hot dogs. They're called rods, and some of them travel in pairs, and some of them make clusters, and some of them are stretched out in long chains, and some of them have little tails on them. Some of them even have little hairs or fingers that help them attach to various surfaces. Some of them are surrounded by protective capsules. Others are not. Some breathe oxygen. Some don't. We call them anaerobic bacteria and aerobic bacteria. So just like aerobic exercise puts a lot of oxygen in your body, aerobic bacteria live in oxygen, like the cut on your finger. Whereas anaerobic bacteria live in a place where there's no oxygen, like deep in the pipes of your bowel. But all bacteria have certain things in common. They have to be able to ingest, they have to be able to eat, they have to be able to digest, they have to be able to metabolize, they have to be able to get rid of waste, and they have to be able to reproduce, just like you and I. They have to generate energy. So when we look at bacteria, they're pretty sophisticated. When we look at viruses, viruses are a completely different type of infectious organism. Besides being incredibly smaller than a bacteria, viruses are not self-sufficient. They have to invade a living cell and use the cell's own machinery in order to reproduce. Viruses actually inject themselves into the cell. In fact, they could even inject themselves into bacteria in order to multiply. So one virus particle is, well, it's relatively simple. It's just a little piece of genetic material like DNA or RNA inside of a shell. And so when you get exposed to a virus like a cold virus, again, about 200 different unique cold viruses, when you get exposed to them, usually your body starts to mount a defense right away. It knows there's a foreign invader. The virus has jumped inside of a cell and claimed it at its own and is using it to multiply. And the first thing that you might notice is a little dry, scratchy place in your throat. Won't be very big. It might be the size of a quarter. and it's down in your throat, a little dry spot, and it's like when you swallow, you can't even get the spit on it. You can't even get the saliva to go over it. It's like the saliva goes around it, because that's a little petri dish where that sucker is starting to inoculate. It's starting to multiply. And that's why your very first line of defense against a cold is the hottest water you can get down your throat. The hottest cup of tea, the hottest vat of coffee, the hottest spoon of soup. A whole lot of these viruses are really heat sensitive. You get a temperature up over 104 degrees and you're going to kill the virus on the spot. You know, threshold of pain is 111 degrees. You can't drink anything hotter than that without scalding yourself. So if you got it over 104 degrees, it's hot. It's not scalding hot, but it's hot. And you let that pour over that little spot in your throat that's kind of dry and scratchy and funky. You might kill that virus right on the spot. It will not have an ability to inoculate and spread. And so that was the first thing that I knew, that I was coming down with a cold. I woke up in the middle of the night and had a funky throat. And I remember laying there in the bed and thinking, Eve, what would you tell your clients? And that would be, get your butt out of bed and go do something about it. And I did. I got out of bed in the wee hours of the morning and went out to my single favorite tool in the kitchen, which is my hot water spigot, and poured myself a couple of ounces of water with steam coming off of it, and waited until it was just below the threshold of pain. And then drank that down. It was too little too late. Now, I have to tell you that it's worked for me a lot of times. I've been exposed to a cold at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and had it gone by 6 o'clock at night. The next symptom that shows up with the cold is it starts to inoculate the respiratory system. And remember, colds are all about the nose. Flus are all about the chest. But colds are all about the nose. And so when I woke up the next morning, the dribble had started, and I knew I had been inoculated. Just dribble. There's no mucus, there's no cough, there's no stuffiness. It's just water coming out like a faucet. At that point, you know you're inoculated. Well, some people are going to go out and get a zinc lozenger, because they did a really good job with the advertising. I just wish that the remedy worked as good as the advertising. Turns out, we don't really have any good science that indicates that using zinc gluconate as a lozenger actually does anything about the cold virus. In fact, the thing that may do something about the cold virus is taking 50,000 IUs of vitamin D all at one time. Yeah, it sounds like a lot, 50,000 IUs, but you're just going to take a single dose. It's like a birth control for viruses. But once inside a living cell, and that virus claims that cell and uses it to multiply, those viral particles scatter to invade other cells and the infection spreads. So it goes from your throat and it goes upstairs into your nose. And to make matters worse, the antibiotics that are so effective against bacteria most of the time are completely useless against viruses. And this is one of the biggest arguments that I have with the medical community, is the number of people who get a cold and end up being prescribed an antibiotic. They go, oh, well, the snodge coming out of my nose is colored, therefore it must be an infection, therefore I must need an antibiotic. But, you know, look at this sequence. You know, you wake up on Monday night with a sore throat, and Tuesday you've got the dribble, and Wednesday you're blowing your nose every 10 minutes, and Thursday you're kind of tired of it. You know, because as your body mounts this immune defense, it does make you feel sort of flat. You're just a little weak. You're just blah. You don't necessarily feel bad, you're just blah. And so by the time that all that snodge is there, you've got some post-nasal drip, and then you can get some cough and an awful lot of throat clearing from it. And by Thursday, you're real over it. And on Friday, you go to the doctor and you get a prescription. And you start that prescription of antibiotics, and Saturday, you're starting to come out of it. But Saturday, you would have been coming out of it anyway. And using an antibiotic for a virus is not only useless, it can harm you. you know, can especially harm the children. We're learning now that the more antibiotics that kids have had when they're really young, the greater their tendency toward obesity. And we certainly know we don't need any help with that particular issue in this country. When we look at the nature of these viruses, antiviral agents are available to combat a few select viruses. You got a shot for polio or hepatitis B or measles at some point, an inoculation to try to fight off those viruses. And there are some things like andrographis and ashwagandha and red root. There are things that actually can make the immune system work better to try to fight and maybe make the virus play out a little less dramatically. But like Grandma said, treat a cold or don't treat a cold still lasts the same amount of time. Now, remember, the other things that it can affect the immune system are things like funguses. You know, everybody's familiar with molds and mushrooms and yeast. These are all examples of fungi. Fungi are life forms that are a little bit more advanced than bacteria, but not as advanced as plants. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of fungi. Almost everybody knows about ringworm and athlete's foot and diaper rash and yeast infections. There are occasions when fungal infections can be deadly, but the fungus that I see most often are overgrowths of these yeasts in the digestive system. Candida, and Candida has 70 different cousins. We know about Candida albicans. Remember, albi in Latin is white, so when you look at it under a microscope, it looks like little white pearls. Candida albicans, Candida tropicalis, Candida parapsilosis, Candida rugosa, you know, it just goes on and on. In fact, I just got a stool study back on a client on Friday that had a species of Candida I've never seen before. I've been doing stool studies for over 25 years, and this was one that I don't even know this name. So Candida's got lots of cousins. It's not just the redhead and the brunette and the blonde. I mean, there's 70 of them in the family. But Candida's only one example of a yeast. You know, the last thing that can turn around and affect the body is a parasite. You know, and those are, again, organisms that are sheltered by some other organ. The parasites are a critter that doesn't offer you anything. You know, they can be everywhere from the microscopic amoeba to a tapeworm dozens of feet long. Yes, dozens of feet long. When I lived in Colorado, I treated a lady who had a tapeworm that happily came out of her body and was over 10 feet long. So when we look at parasitic diseases like malaria, and we look at you know, some of those TV shows on educational TV about parasites where you see really oogie things that make you freak, you know that antiparasitic, well, maybe we'll do a show on parasites at some point, but antiparasitic strategies can be pretty dramatic. But let's circle ourselves back again to this virus, especially to this cold virus. So now you've got this virus. And this virus is this simple piece of RNA or DNA that's wrapped in a protective shell. And it's specifically adapted to inject its genetic material into a bacteria or a cell by attaching to them and then starting to multiply. And then you got the symptoms. Well, from a holistic standpoint, you don't treat all colds the same because all colds aren't the same. They all have a different character. Some people have really a very lousy sore throat. Other colds may have a sore throat that only lasts a couple of hours. We use a throat remedy for that. Red root happens to be one of my favorites when we're talking about that. Red root is one of the herbs that I can recall when I was doing herbal medicine out in Arizona and Colorado that we would have beginning students, novices, or associates that would come out to learn about how to pick herbs. And, you know, one of the things that we would sick on them is digging valerian root and digging red root, because it's just really a royal pain in the, you pick a body part. But red root is probably, I don't know, 50 species of ceanothus that grow anywhere from Canada all the way to Guatemala. I don't know that it grows anywhere else. When we look at ceanothus or red root, it's a lymph system stimulant. And since the tonsils are lymph organs, just like the appendix is, when we take red root, and I happen to like tinctures, tinctures are where you dissolve the medicinal constituent of a plant in a combination of alcohol and water, and the ratio of those alcohol and water mixtures are unique to every plant. So one plant might be 50% water and 50% alcohol, and another plant could be 80% alcohol and 20% water. It depends on how much you need in order to extract the medicine. Remember, when you make a tea, you can only extract the compounds that are soluble in water. So if there are medicinal compounds in there that are not soluble in water, then you're not going to get them in the tea. Plus, the majority of the teas that you have to use medicinally are called strong decoctions. You practically can't gag them down. They're so nasty. It's not the same as a culinary tea. You know, I get these clients all the time that come in and they say, oh, I drink echinacea tea for my cold. Yeah, well, I'll set fire to a $5 bill. It'll be more fun. The nature of it is you can't get a high enough concentration. When you're using a teaspoon of herb to make a cup of tea, that's not a medicinal concentration. And so when you use a tincture, you're able to get a higher concentration of the medicinal constituents that are in the plant. And just taking a dropper full, which is about 30 drops into about a tablespoon of water, and then gargle with that, and then swallow. And then the red root is affecting that lymph system tissue in your throat immediately. It's also anti-inflammatory for the liver and the spleen. It's astringent. It's a mucous membrane tonic. It's antiseptic. It's expectorant. It's antispasmodic. It's, you know, got a lot of benefits. And so red root is one of the very first herbs that I would grab in terms of the stage that is the sore throat. But once you start making snodge, once you start making mucus, then anything that contributes to making mucus, you want to reduce in the diet. And interestingly enough, if I ask 10 people what is a mucus-forming food, most people are going to say dairy first, but that's not always the case. Sometimes the most mucus-forming food is sugar. Even though, surprisingly, one of the herbal antibiotics is honey. So sometimes honey itself acts as an antibiotic for the body and an antibacterial as well. You know, I learned about using honey on wounds when I lived out in Arizona. So when we look at the snodge, we want things that are going to thin it. I use a combination herbal tea that thins the mucus. And this is a place where a decoction or a tea is appropriate to use, because you like the comforting effect of sipping on that hot cup of tea 3 or 4 times a day. And these anti-mucilage teas help to thin the mucus, not only to keep it moving, because where people end up with a secondary bacterial infection from a cold is when the mucus gets stuck. It gets thicky and it gets stuck, and then the bacteria go in and think it's a smorgasbord, and we get a secondary infection. So not only does the demulcent kind of tea help to keep the mucus thin, if the mucus is thin, it doesn't just move. Your body can actually resorb it. And, you know, that's not a concept a lot of people get right away, that you can resorb mucus. You can have it be squirted out, and then you can suck it back in again. And so the nature of using various herbs at various times becomes important. You know, I did a slam against echinacea, but in fact, purple coneflower, what we called it in the West, shouldn't be slammed at all. Echinacea is really quite a remarkable plant. It gets standardized when it's made into a tincture. We use the root of it, and so whenever you see an echinacea tincture that says whole plant, and some people will say, well, you have to have the balance of using a whole plant. You need the stems and the leaves as well as the root. Well, that's nonsense, because what's true is that the dry root is the active medicine. And we want echinacea angustifolia. The nature of that particular echinacea is the powerful one for tonsillitis. It's the powerful one for the onset of colds and flus. And so that's where we take a dropper full of this tincture and put it in about 1 to 2 tablespoons of water and slug it back. If we're using red root and echinacea together, a really terrific combination, then gargling with that before we swallow it, we're going to get the benefit to the throat, and we're going to get the benefit of the whole systemic effect of the herb. When we look at the treatment of a cold holistically, what we never want to do is stop the process. A lot of people grab an antihistamine. And an antihistamine, because their nose is dribbling, so they think, well, I'm going to stop that liquid. But in fact, when you stop it, because, you know, everybody's got to go to work. They got to go to work, so they got to be okay to go to work. And they take that antihistamine and they dry that stuff up. They can actually make the cold last longer, because then the snodge doesn't move, and there's more of a potential for getting a secondary infection. In holistic medicine, you're thinking in a different way. You're thinking about continuing to keep the flow going. And so what you do with a cold from a holistic standpoint is you break apart the symptoms. The sore throat is one thing. The snodgy nose is another thing. The cough is a third thing. And you treat each of those things individually. When you think that way, you begin to understand the concept of a syndrome. A syndrome is different from a disease. A cold isn't a disease, it's a syndrome. You put together a collection of symptoms, a cough, sneezing, dribbly nose, mucus making, sore throat. That collection of symptoms is a syndrome. And each of those syndromes is unique, and it's also unique according to you. If you've got a huge backlog of mucus because you happen to be one of the people that's dairy sensitive, and you're always honking out phlegm balls and clearing your throat and, you know, making beeping and honking noises because you've got snodge going down the back of your throat, you can feel it, then when you get a cold, it's going to be a whole lot more violent than somebody who doesn't have a backlog of mucus. Because you got more of that crud already in there that's got to come out. So two people can catch the same virus and have very different reactions. And speaking of catching, one of the things that you want to do is to realize that the greatest amount of prevention is to be able to wash your hands. You know, this is one where Ma was right. We need to wash our hands a whole lot more often. The reason is because these cold viruses can live for up to 3 hours. So the lady that's got the cold that went to the mall before you and she sneezed into her hand and she put her hand on the rail of the escalator, and you come by an hour later and put your hand on the same rail, and then you rub your nose. You know, I read these things that say, don't touch your nose and eyes. Oh, freaking get real. Who's going to do that? Who's going to remember to do that? I don't know. It ain't going to be this blonde. So when we look at the fact that we're touching surfaces all the time, and I see people in the bathroom, you know, it's a real interesting statistic that if there's somebody else in the bathroom with you in a public bathroom, you'll wash your hands more often than if you're the only one that's in there. How dumb is that? What you want to be in the habit of doing, especially since February is flu month in Sarasota County, is washing your hands. Now, granted, flu gets transported much more often through the air, through particulate of somebody coughing and sneezing. And flu gets transmitted much more easily in cold weather. And considering it's going to be 79 degrees today, the only flu that's going to get transmitted are the people that are getting off the plane from up north. But if they cough in your face, if they sneeze on you, you just got exposed. So as we begin to look at how flu is different, we want to understand washing your hands can protect you on both sides of those events. But you don't really have much in the way of being able to put yourself in a bubble. Now, I use beta-glucans. Beta-glucans is a compound that can come to us from things like oats, but can also come to us through the cell wall of baker's yeast. And beta-glucans does make the white blood cells act like, well, snipers. Makes the white blood cells more targeted to look for bad guys. So people who have a tendency to catch more things than others, especially if they're in an environment where that happens, like they're working in daycare or they're working at the car rental agency at the airport. You know, those are people I'm going to put on beta-glucans to try to give them a greater amount of defense. I use immunoglobulins. Immunoglobulins like we find in colostrum, the very first secretion from the breast of any mammal, human included. Cows included, that colostrum, that first expression that comes out of the breast, contains a whole lot of IgG antibodies, and those antibodies can capture, just like your own white blood cells, IgGs, capture some of these invaders. So there are some things that we can do that can actually build immunity. The use of herbs like ashwagandha are beneficial in terms of giving the body a little bit better of a chance to resist. So if, you know, if I was going to make a list of the herbs that are going to benefit the body and make the immune system as targeted as we can, then, you know, I'd probably have to put ashwagandha, astragalus, reishi mushroom, red root echinacea, up there on the top of the list. But let's talk about flu for a minute. Flu is really a very different kind of virus. It's a more virulent virus. It still inoculates the way that all viruses do, but flus change every year. Actually, we're getting a replay of the 2009 H1N1. Remember 2009 when they were essentially telling us there were going to be dump trucks in the street picking up the bodies because so many people were dying from H1N1? Well, H1N1 has showed up again. They've actually had a case of it here in Florida. But the nature of flus is they evolve. And flus essentially move from west to east. That's the reason that you hear them called Asian flu and Hong Kong flu and Taiwanese flu and swine flu and bird flu. Why swine flu and bird flu? Because a lot of times in the impoverished areas of Asia, your pig or your chicken is the single most valuable thing you own because it's going to provide you food tomorrow. And so it sleeps in the house with you. Well, yeah. It sleeps with you. I don't mean the pig is in the bed, but it still sleeps in your house. And so it's easy for our DNA and the DNA of the swine or the bird to interact with each other and evolve bird flus and swine flus, etc. So as these flus move from west to east, we get a different mix of them. We may get 6 or 12 different flus over the course of the season. The flu shot this year has 4 species of flu in it. too severe and too mild. But you might get flu number 5. And even if you got the flu shot, you're not protected by it. You know, I think the flu shot is a smart thing for people to get if they've got any kind of lung or heart issue. If you've got asthma, if you're a smoker, if you've had a history of bronchitis, if you're pregnant, certainly. If you're a young child that has had respiratory problems, you know, those are people that I think that the flu vaccine is beneficial for. People say, I get the flu from flu vaccine. That's nonsense. That absolutely doesn't happen. You might get an immune response from it, especially if you have an allergy to eggs, because all the flu vaccines, for the most part, are grown on eggs. There are some flu vaccines available today that are not grown on eggs. But you can't get the flu from the flu vaccine. When we look at the nature of flus, these various species come every year, and that's the reason that people need to get a flu shot every year that are susceptible. When you look at the difference between the inconvenience and the, you know, moderate $25 cost of getting a flu shot versus the idea of being in the bed for 7 to 9 days, I think the gamble is worth it. When you look at flu, flu differs from a cold. Colds come on slow. You get the dribbly nose and the scratchy throat. Flus come on like a freight train. You're okay at 1 o'clock and you're okay at 1:30, and at 2 o'clock you've been hit by a truck. You want to get the license plate number of that truck and get them to come back and finish the job, because almost all flus start with fever and muscle or joint pain. You feel like crud immediately. And the nature of the flu is all about the chest. It's all about the lungs. So what we're wanting to do when we're treating flu is to put more emphasis on the herbs that affect the lung, things like OSHA root, O-S-H-A. OSHA is one of the primary lung treatments. This is a place that red root comes in again, echinacea comes in again, andrographis. These herbs are vital, especially in the onset of the flu. And there's a homeopathic remedy that's actually made from mallard ducks that is a pretty popular homeopathic remedy, even sold in the local drugstores, that if you take it right at the very onset of the flu, can often make the flu very minimized. At least it doesn't get horrible. You may still be down for a week, but it'll be a milder version than if you didn't hit it with the homeopathic remedy right away. I keep these little vials of these homeopathic pellets with me during flu season. I keep one vial in my nightstand, one vial in my purse, and one vial in my desk drawer. Because if I were to get symptoms, I'm less than an arm's length away from one of those three vials that I can get into me right away. 6 hours later, do the second vial. 6 hours later, do the third vial. Even if I had to wake up in the middle of the night to take the third vial, it's still better than coming down with the flu. So with the flu, what you're trying to do is keep those fluids going so you keep that mucus moving from the chest. And you use something called gravity-assisted drainage. Gravity-assisted drainage is where you lay across the bed on your belly. Your waistline is at the edge of the bed, your hips and your legs are on the bed, and the upper part of your torso is headed to the floor. You've got to put a couple of big pillows under you to get even remotely comfortable. It's a miserable position. But what you're doing is exactly as the name implied, gravity-assisted drainage. You're trying to lay down and aim yourself down in such a way that gravity helps to drain that crud out of your lungs so it doesn't settle down into the bottom third of your lungs. And the objective is to lay there for 2 minutes and rest, and then breathe deeply to deliberately incite the cough, and then hacka those hairballs out of there. And then rest for 2 minutes, and then breathe deeply to deliberately incite the cough, and do a couple of 3-4 cycles of that. If you've got a headache, it'll be almost impossible because it'll be so miserable. If you've got an inversion table, you can use the inversion table. But gravity-assisted drainage helps to keep us from having too much of those hairballs, as I call them, down in the lungs, and keeps you once again from ending up with a secondary infection. You know, the old feed a cold and starve a fever. Well, the fever is there for a purpose. And one of the newer things that was discovered is that if you take acetaminophen or you take aspirin or you take naproxen or, you know, any of these over-the-counter pain relievers to get rid of the aches of the flu, you'll actually shed more virus as a result. So if you happen to live in a household and you take those painkillers, you actually have a greater chance of infecting the other people that are in the house. When we look at the fever, my rule is if the fever is under 101, I don't treat it at all. If it's 101 to 104, then I treat it hourly with homeopathic fever remedies. And if it's over 104, I treat it every 15 minutes until the fever comes back down, doing simple things, the things that we did, you know, in the days before we had all of this supposed sophistication, like cooling yourself off with cool cloths, is one of the ways to control a fever, because the fever is there. The pyrotechnics of the body are there to try to kill the virus. And so if you break the fever deliberately by using those things, you actually eliminate one of the immune cell's functions to try to control the virus. And so you may actually feel a little better, but you may not be doing your body any real favors in terms of the longevity or the severity of the flu. You know, there's probably not a month that goes by that I don't have somebody coming in saying, I got that 24-hour stomach flu. And what I have to remember to tell virtually everybody is there isn't any such thing. 99% of the time, that 24-hour stomach flu, as you called it, was food poisoning. There's no such thing as a 24-hour virus. It takes about a week for your white blood cells, these B cells, these antibodies, to be manufactured from a stem cell against that particular variety of flu. So again, if you got H1N1, you're not going to get H1N1 again, because now you have an antibody against H1N1. When the stem cells give birth to these five different kinds of immature blood cells that over time, you know, mature into T cells and B cells, etc., at that particular juncture of maturing, we have to have good vitality in our blood. And that good vitality in our blood is really based on what you're putting in your body every single solitary day. So when I read these things that say you can lessen your chances of getting cold and flu by washing your hands, I totally agree with that. Getting more sleep, reducing your stress, eating a good diet, drinking more fluids. Well, there isn't a day that I don't recommend that. That we're drinking pure water, and we're eating real food, and we're getting our sleep, because sleep is one of the single best immune modulators that you possibly have. So, I got a cold, and I treated it, and I did go to work, and I do very much hope that I never exposed anybody. I was inordinately careful to not expose anybody. But you know what? Like Grandma taught me, if you treat a cold, it lasts 7 days, and if you don't treat a cold, it lasts a week. Here it is a week later, and we're done with it.